Let us make man in our image after our likeness.
After 6 weeks, here we are on verse 26, right? racing along. And I wanted to say some things at the start to connect what we are talking about now with what we've been talking about previously with plants and animals. And then I want to move on to what's distinctively happening here in, about man. I do want to say some things about our author. We were reading St. Basil, and now we're you had an excerpt from St. Gregory of Nyssa, so I want to talk about the relation of those two. First thing I wanted to talk about was in the world of the Church Fathers, they do not have Darwin, evolution. They don't have the kind of intellectual challenges that a modern Christian gets from the scientific world, especially from the world of evolutionary biology. But certainly what they had was Epicureanism, which goes back, of course, to Epicurus. Epicurus is a Greek author around the 2nd century BC, maybe 3rd century, but I think 2nd century. And the more influential person in the Roman world would have been Lucretius. Lucretius de Rerum Natura, On the Nature of Things. On the Nature of Things is a long poem. It's a 6-book poem. And it takes the Epicurean position and makes it beautiful and compelling. And it's basically the view of Epicurus is there is any order there is in the universe is really apparent. Because ultimately, the universe is all composed of atoms. So if you remember your pre-Socratics, Democritus was the one who comes up with this first atomic theory. So basically, everything is atoms and void. Everything is accidental assemblages of the atoms. So the universe is not a universe that has that's been designed or created by some kind of God, guided by some kind of intelligence. No, it's all matter and void. And so that there's any order or purpose to the universe is apparent. It's just an appearance or an illusion. But really, everything can be explained by atoms and the properties of these atoms. So you never want to think that somehow in the past you didn't have people who had materialism occur to them as a notion. In other words, that you can just explain everything from matter. That idea has been around for a while. You don't want to think, well, of course, everybody 2,500, 2,000 years ago, they all thought it was the gods, and now we're all real smart, and we know that, you know, nature is a cause. No, there are a number of writers, not just in Greece, in the same period. It's around 500 BC. You have the same thing occur in India. You have the same thing occur in China. This is a period that's called the Axial Age. All these different thinkers are coming up with completely materialistic explanations of the world. Okay, the Church Fathers, on the other hand, believe in divine providence. And by divine providence, that God provides for his universe. He's created it, and he's ordering it to the good. So the idea of providence is not just creation. It's that you are directing that universe in some way to its perfection. You have some idea of its goodness. I've remarked before, but it's worth repeating, you would not believe how difficult it is to get students at this institution to remember the meaning of divine providence. There's something almost a little ironic about that. But unfortunately, I think the problem is when you grow up in a wealthy, high-tech, prosperous, comfortable, largely crime-free existence, you just don't think of there really needing to be a God running things. The economy does it. The American military does it. My parents' nice job does it, right? The gross national product. This is what you think of as really providing. And conversely, people who don't have prosperity,
who don't have security, who don't have those things, very often are people who do have a greater awareness of divine providence because they don't take those things for granted. If you grow up in prosperity and abundance, it is very difficult for you not to take those things for granted. The only reason I think why in my upbringing I had the opportunity not to is because my father would keep reminiscing about the Great Depression and the Second World War. He was born in 1935, and that made an impression on him. And he was always convinced that the economy was going to collapse. That was something I was raised with. You never know when everything is just going to collapse. Now you might think that would just engender anxiety. You're traumatizing the child. But what it gave me a sense of was how fragile things can be. He talks about how it is that people would come to the back door begging for egg sandwiches. They come to the back door, they were ashamed to come to the front. And my grandmother would make them egg sandwiches, basically fry an egg and put it in two pieces of bread and give it to these people at the back door. And my father, seeing that at age 5, just thought, I never want to be in that position. I never want to be begging at the back of people's doors for egg sandwiches. That stuck with him. So there's a way in which it's easier to have a sense of divine providence when you actually have less abundance, because you recognize or see God as the source, that it's not all up to you, that you don't control all of it. Now, of course, for the church fathers, they're not just thinking about that providence in the sense of our lives. They're thinking big picture, that the universe is a universe that's ordered. It's not a universe at random. It's not a universe assembled by the motions of atoms. It is a universe in which God has not only brought it into being, but directed it, moved it in ways, and more importantly, given to creatures the causality which allows them to achieve the good. He's not moving it all like a puppet master. He has put in his creatures their inner tendencies, their inner inclinations to seek the goods that will perfect them. It's an important thing to realize that the church fathers, many of them come from a background that you would recognize if you read Aristotle and Aristotle's treatises on nature. They consider purpose and nature self-evident. What for us could be a controversy, they think that it's obvious that nature is a kind of thing that is working for goals. It isn't working for goals because it's, it's like just human beings are manipulating things. Yeah, spiders, left to their own, are going to make webs and catch flies. Beavers, unimpeded, are going to make dams and get fish. Bees, unimpeded, they are going to make hives and make honey. And for us as modern people, our tendency is to just sort of imagine these sort of proto-beavers or proto-bees or proto-spiders that somehow developed into all this. But Aristotle is always working with what's in front of him. And what's in front of him is animals that are and plants and all sorts of other things that have inner inclinations to the good. So there is purpose in nature because nature is a principle that directs things to the goods that perfect whatever that natural thing is. When people read church fathers, they read Basil or Gregory of Nyssa, and they see that idea of order and purpose in nature. Sometimes what they draw is, oh, isn't this just like what intelligent design is? Isn't what's going on in the church fathers a kind of a version of intelligent design? And the answer is no. Because when you read people in the intelligent design movement, in a way, they're coming right out of that sort of more modern point of view. The intelligent design movement looks at natural things as if they're sort of mechanisms, as if they're sort of working by their own material attributes. And then you come to these things that can't seem to be explained that way. So you'll hear expressions like irreducible complexity.
Like, here I am looking at the tail on a flagellum, or I'm looking at the eye. It's like I assume a kind of mechanistic explanation until I come to something that just looks so complex that I just say, wow, that can't just be an accident. That can't be chance. It has to be designed that way. Okay? But notice the starting point is as if you're going in and thinking of things just being having functions or just being sort of material necessity, and then being pushed, as it were, to see that they're sort of designed or put together. Okay, if you've heard the example of Paley's watch, you walk, this is an argument by an Anglican divine, William Paley. You walk on the beach, you pick up a watch. Could you think that that watch, when you start breaking it apart, was just sort of a work of nature? The fact that it has all these parts that fit together, it looks like it's designed. Okay, that is not the way that church fathers and pagan or pre-Christian philosophers like Aristotle think. They are not thinking, I'm looking at something which is just sort of material and purposeless, but then I run into these things that just look like they're put together. No, they think that there is purpose is self-evident. It's not something that you're reasoning to be a natural thing. Means that you are working for some kind of purpose. So maybe a way of thinking about it, think back to when you had health class as a sixth grader or seventh grader, and they talked about the purpose of the stomach and the purpose of the lungs and the purpose of the blood, and even if they did, what are these organs for? That's the kind of thing that Aristotle would say. How do you talk about an organ system without talking about what it's for? How do you even get started if you don't have this idea that there are these goods that are accomplished by the digestive tract, that all of these different organs fit in to that goal or fit into that purpose? Get the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff. How do you get off the ground in terms of talking about a circulatory system unless you're talking about the good that circulating the blood, oxygen, nutriments is about? It is completely artificial to talk about, especially living things, as if they didn't have purposes. By the way, very often the way that people get out of educated, only educated people could be this dim, the way that highly educated people get out, they just refer to them as functions. So these are all just functions, which is a code for saying this is just what they do. We're not saying that they have purposes or they're for something. This is just what they do. Well, what kind of explanation is that? How does it make any sense to, in a digestive system, to just say the stomach does this and the intestines, large and small, do that, if it isn't in light of some good for which those organs and organ systems do what they do? So that I think is an important difference. Intelligent design, for all that it has going for it, is not a return to things that, for example, are in the Church Fathers. When you see words like design or order and so on, you can get the idea, hey, this is the same kind of thing. Intelligent design is a response to something modern, and it carries something modern along with the package. It doesn't look at nature as self-evidently purposeful and ordered. It doesn't look at it that way. They're still in that scientific formation of things are, as it were, they do things, but they don't have purposes. There's still that idea of function, but now you're looking at things that function with such complexity that you have to say, well, there's some kind of intelligence that's involved. Let's talk a little bit about St. Gregory, who we're reading here. He's part of what are called the Cappadocian Fathers. I had to re-look this up myself. Cappadocia is a region of what is now modern Turkey. And the thing that's easy to forget, when you look at Turkey, you think of it as being full of, well, Turks. Turkey used to be called Asia Minor, and it was full of Greek colonists. And a lot of the communities that are these early Christian communities, like Ephesus, they're part of Asia Minor. Cappadocia, when you look at a map of Turkey, it's north and central. So if you look at a map of modern Turkey, right in the middle of Turkey is Ankara. That's the capital. So it's actually that region north of it. And that had a number of Greek colonists, and these were early converts to Christianity. These folks are in the 4th century. They're in the 300s. St. Basil and St. Gregory of Nyssa, they're brothers. Well, then how come it's not St. Basil of Nyssa? Because he didn't need an of something. There's only one Basil, right? We didn't need to distinguish him. In the East, there are just too many Gregories. It's like, you know, there are too many, you know, you have a school like this, there are just too many Matts and too many Emmas, and, you know, so you need to start distinguishing them. But Gregory is kind of like that. You can just imagine this kindergarten, you know, full of all these Gregories. I don't remember the boys' names, but I just remember when I was in kindergarten, it seemed to me I was surrounded by Julies, Kimberlys, Sharons, and Jennifers. Okay, so you can almost like date when I was in kindergarten by the names of the girls that were in my class. Nobody names girls Kimberly anymore. I haven't met a Kimberly in forever. Sharon is rare. There's still some stray Jennifers. And all these other names have come back, like Helen. Helen is a beautiful name. There were 80-year-old women named Helen. Well, you know, when I was a kid, there were no young girls named Helen. So there are a lot of lovely names that are coming back. But no more Julies and no more Jennifers and no more Sharons. Okay, but certainly no Kimberlys. So these two are brothers. Basil is the older one. Gregory is the younger one. Gregory of Nyssa is the younger one. Basil writes the Hexameron, the work on the 6 days. And what Gregory writes on the making of man, because Basil just wrote on the 6 days, what his younger brother is doing is completing it. He's writing on the creation of man. He's essentially writing on these key points from chapter 2. Older brother writes about chapter 1. Younger brother writes about chapter 2. Okay, and the third Cappadocian father, St. Gregory of Nazianzen, he's not related, but he is a friend. I think it's Basil and Gregory of Nazianzen. They become friends in college. And an interesting thing about all of these very educated and very intelligent saints, all of them went to pre-Christian pagan schools. Remember, there aren't things as Catholic grade schools and Catholic high schools and Catholic colleges. None of those things exist. All of these early church fathers were pagan educated. You know, for those of us who don't have, let's say, the ability to send our kid to a school like Providence, people that we know that their kids are in public school by kind of economic necessity. In a way, when you look at folks in the early church, they were in that same boat. They didn't have Catholic schools. They didn't have religious schools. So the kind of prudential question about how do you educate your kids when the schools are hostile to what you believe. That was a live question for Christians for about the first 6, 7, almost 8 centuries of the church. You know, it's easy to forget that the whole first part of early Christian history, there aren't, as it were, centers of Christian intellect or centers of Christian learning. Or to the extent there are, they're very unusual. Alexandria had a catechetical school. That was unusual. Okay, there aren't those things. Gregory of Nyssa also writes a defense of Basil because there are people who are attacking his brother's work, and he writes this 80-page work defending the Hexameron. So these are like loyal brothers. The final thing to say, Gregory of Nazianzen, there are a couple of things that we're going to see by him later on, so I do have some selections from Gregory of Nazianzen. He's the one who gets this distinguished title, the theologian. And the reason he's called the theologian in the East is because of these theological orations that he writes, and most important, in defense of the divinity of our Lord. Because this is in the era of the Arian heresy. But all these are your three, along with Athanasius and John Chrysostom. These are your major Eastern fathers. Okay. So let's now talk about image and likeness. An important thing to remember about the word image in Greek, the word for image is icon. So when we talk about image, you want to sort of have this the connotation or suggestion of the way in which you're having a picture that points upward, right? An icon is not just religious art. The idea is that you're providing a doorway or a pointer to something supernatural. When you see icons, iconographic art, and it looks two-dimensional, and you just think, gosh, couldn't these guys figure out how to put some depth in there? No, their idea was an icon should be distorted in a way because we don't want to give you the sense that you're just seeing the world. When you look at Renaissance art, the strong point of it is that it's realistic. But the downside of it is you can have the humanity of the people emphasized in a way to the detriment of their what's divine or supernatural. The extreme of that can be you have these paintings of the Blessed, I think of the Red Virgin by, it's one of the French painters I'm blanking on, but what I remember is it's the king's mistress, Agnès Sorel, is used as a model for the Virgin Mary. So you'll have, in other words, these kind of celebrities who get painted as Our Lord or Our Lady or as the apostles, that realism can sometimes be distracting. It just becomes human, like the human world that you live in. There's some precedent. If you look in Egyptian art, the pharaoh is always twice as big as everybody else. And it's not because pharaohs were 12 feet tall, or it's because they think that if you just see the pharaoh as sort of being like the same size as the people around him, you're not getting how important pharaoh is. And so that's why it is in icons when you see our Lord. He doesn't look like a bambino with, chubby cheeks. He looks like a little man. But that's because from the point of view of an iconographer, if you're thinking of him as a baby just like other babies, then you don't understand who he is. So that's why they represent him as a little man. So when you look at Adam and Eve being made to the image and likeness, that there's a way in which what you're seeing in man is an icon of divinity, right? And again, it's not in the same way that divinity is, just like what's in the picture is not fully able to express the divine reality that it represents. But there's something in this that points upward to a supernatural reality. And very early on, church fathers are going to identify that image and likeness as mind and will, that you're able to know, that you're able to choose, that you're able to love. That is what you have that nothing else in nature has. So the way I used to explain this to the sophomores, they were reading Paradise Lost. And I said, okay, so imagine Michael or Lucifer, they're scouting out the garden. Okay? In fact, there's this memorable scene in Paradise Lost where Lucifer is basically scouting out the garden, looking for vulnerabilities, ways to get back at God. If you were in that garden and you looked at the plants and you looked at the trees, they would not have reminded you of the angelic home you came from. If you had been looking at the animals, nope, it's not going to remind you of where you were. But once you came upon Adam and Eve and they're talking, okay, they're not angels, they're not spirits, they're not God, but these would be the first things that would remind you of the spiritual world from where you came. Okay? So these are the first things that were that point upward, because these are beings that are able to know, and that's why they're able to talk. They wouldn't be able to talk if they weren't able to know. What about Coco? She's got American Sign Language. Okay, yes, you can get animals to associate. That's how Coco can do sign language. She can associate. But speech is not just association. Speech gives you access to a much bigger world. Coco, remember, any sign she gives, she has to be able to see what's being signed. In other words, she can sign for red or green or whatnot. She can sign for colors. But she can't give a sign for color. That abstract concept. She can't do that. She can do cat, bird, right? She can give signs for those kind of things. But like animal, right? Can Coco bear taxonomic categories in her head? She can't do it. She can't sign for things that she can't see or sense. So we'll talk more about this when we get to the naming of the animals. But the power of speech is reflecting your ability to get big things about the world around you, to think abstractly. Right? The example I give the sophomores, it's after lunch, so I don't want you to think this is cruel. When you have that big plateful of double chunk chocolate chip brownies, and you're thinking to yourself, these could be pleasurable, these are yummalicious, okay? Right? And you've got this concept, pleasure. And then, right, you think, but I am getting adult onset diabetes just smelling them, right? Health. When you encounter things in light of ideas. For animals, there's food, it smells good, they eat it. That's all there is to say. And maybe for teenage boys. But for human beings, having those distinctive powers of mind and will and whatnot, there never is just the sensual experience. There's the ideas by which we make judgments. That's how we have free will. The way that we're able to rise above instinct is we're able to understand things about the world that an animal cannot. So image is going to mean those powers of mind and will. There are some patristic writers who think that likeness is just kind of a repetition, just like image, in other words. But you see this in Gregory of Nyssa, and it's developed more in St. John Damascene and St. John Chrysostom. They see image as meaning, right, that you've got mind and will, that you share in the divine nature. But then likeness is the degree to which you are sharing in that divine nature. So, for example, that just by being human, you have mind and will. That is a very basic way in which you are like God. But that you would be free from, that you'd be washed from original sin, and that you'd be infused with sanctifying grace. Remember the term that St. Peter uses, that grace is a sharing in the divine life. Now you're being elevated. That is a greater sharing in the image, right? That you have a mind and will that are now able to believe and hope and love. That's a greater sharing in that divine image. Best of all, that you would die in a state of grace, that you would be united in the beatific vision, that your mind would have the fullness of beholding the truth with a capital T, that your will would be full of beauty and goodness with a capital B and a G, that you would be receiving that you would be a soul in glory. That is the highest way of sharing in that image. So likeness conveys the differences in degree. An image is stating, as it were, the goal, right? That you are in greater and greater conformity to God Himself, whose image you're being created in. One of the things that has been popular lately is this idea that we're made in the image and likeness of God. God's a Trinity, and God's a community, and that somehow the family is now an image of the Trinity. Sometimes the support that's given for that is that made to the image and likeness of God, male and female, He made them. I understand that what's going on there is, I think what people seek to do is give a kind of further defense to the family. This lovely gift of God that they see is just under fire and under attack. And so to anchor it in the Trinity seems to give it sort of additional support. But theologically and biblically, that's not a reasonable way to argue. St. Augustine, in fact, will take on the view that could you talk about mother, father, child as a kind of a trinity? And he says no. The trinity proceeds in a very different way. In fact, you have paternity without maternity, right, in the divine trinity. But when you see made to the image and likeness of God, male and female, he made them. If you were to say that male and female is the way we share in the image, then why wouldn't all animals share in the Trinity? Right? Why wouldn't Papa Dog, Mama Dog, and Puppy be an image of the Trinity? The only reason that male, female, as human beings could even be conceivably like that is because they got mind and will. Because you're talking about persons. You're not just talking about animals. So the thing to say is this. When it says, made to the image and likeness of God, male and female, that means both men and women share in being made to the image and likeness of God. This isn't something that men have and women don't. There's an emphasis on both of the sexes sharing this. Now, that's very ordinary to us, but remember, there are belief systems and mythological systems where women are actually ontologically inferior. They don't have the same gifts or abilities or creation as the men. And here you're pointing out male and female, both made to the image and likeness of God. Okay? And the only way that you would talk about, the only way it's thinkable that male and female would be part of that is if, again, if you weren't talking about human beings, but each of them have that image. It's not male and female together. Again, I don't think it's an error where the person intends to say something bad. I think they're trying to say something good. They're trying to give a shout out to the family. But you don't want to give a shout out to the family by saying they're like the Trinity. They're not. Okay, they're not. It's almost like so at its worst, you'll hear things like God is a community of persons, but a family is a community of persons. Well, you know what? The Minnesota Vikings are a community of persons. You know, you don't want to simply smoosh everything together in indeterminacy because it's a community of persons. Let's talk about persons. The other phrase, it was earlier than Pope John Paul II, but I think John Paul II was somebody with whom we associate this. The dignity of the human person, that in an age of ideologies, you know, communism and socialism and fascism, that you lose a sense of the dignity of the individual. But we're not just going to say individual because, you know, stones can be individual and trees can be individual. Human beings are the things that we're going to call persons. Okay, when you're talking about a person implies that it's an individual of special worth or an individual of special dignity. One of the things that, unfortunately, again, I think we've fallen into is focusing on that individual, trying to capture the worth of the individual, but trying to do it on the very basis of the individuality as opposed to the kind of individual. What do I mean? You will have, again, well-intentioned youth ministers, people usually working with the young. They sit there and they tell them, you are an irrepeatable creation of God. There is no one quite like you. There's no one before you that's ever quite existed, and no one after you. You are uniquely made. Okay, I understand that the well-intention behind it, but our worth does not come from our individuality. Maybe there are very unique hedgehogs out there. Maybe there are very unique porcupines, rhododendrons. Maybe we have a butterfly that there is no butterfly quite like that particular monarch butterfly born on May 4th, 1972. But the thing that gives you your worth is not just your individuality in its very individuality. It's that you are an individual of a rational nature. You are an individual with a mind and a will. And the reason that's important to tell our young people, you don't just want to be emphasizing how they're different from everybody else around them. You want to be emphasizing the special gifts that they share in common with everybody else, which then creates responsibilities. Again, the expression of Pope John Paul II, where there is gift, there is task. You have a mind. You have a will. You are meant to know. You are meant to choose. You are meant to love. To understand yourself as a person means that you understand that there are certain goods which you are supposed to seek. Now, I'm all for emphasizing the individuality. Once that is clear, now we can talk about what does God call you to do in your life? For example, marriage versus religious life, or what he calls you to in a profession, or what he calls you to in terms of like where you live, what college you go to. Those are all things which now we're discerning how we're going to carry out God's will. But we're all going to have a common vocation to holiness. We're all going to have a common vocation to discerning and obeying God's will. We're all going to have a common vocation to the theological virtues and the cardinal virtues. There are all these things that we're going to have in common because we're all human person with minds and hearts and wills. So those things are all going to be the same. Again, I'm all for emphasizing what's unique once that common vocation has been made clear. Now, I'm all for emphasizing what's special about the person once we've made clear like what a person is. Remember, especially with our young people, you might think those things are clear to them, and they're just not. And it's not because teacher isn't making it clear. Remember, I am working against whatever they're getting from TV and movies and the popular culture and their phones. I and other teachers are working against, you know, besides you, everything else. So they're, what they get from the culture around them is that they're animals. Okay, they're animals that drive cars and can make pancakes, but they don't have something unique in terms of their minds and wills, unique human goods. That is not what they get from the culture around them. So it is a constant battle to get them to see that they have something that raises them above the animals, that they have a kind of happiness that isn't just pleasure or good feeling. They have love, which is not just biochemistry or affection or habit. They have love that can come from choice and commitment and a real knowing and understanding who the beloved is. Right? That is not what their culture is giving them. So to help them in their path in life, the first and most basic thing is, you know, who are you as a human being? You know, imagination is important. Emotions, all those things are important. But ultimately, the kind of imagination, emotion, all those things that we have, they are what they are because we have minds, because we have wills, because we're able to know and to choose and to love. So Boethius is the church father who will talk about how it is that we use the word person of the Trinity, of these individuals in the Trinity, because person implies that you're an individual of kind of special status or special worth. A person, it comes from the theater, right? It comes from like persons in the play, that you're we would say characters, but you're you have a certain role or certain you have a part in this play. You're an individual of importance, right? And so we transfer that to the Trinity, but we also transfer it to ourselves, that we're not things or objects or animals, that we're persons, meaning we're individuals of a certain worth. And that's what Thomas Aquinas will appeal to when he talks about the dignity of the person, that we have this special worth because we're individuals who are able to know and choose and love. Are there things from either last week or the reading today that you wanted to ask about or need some clarity on? We have just a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
I have a question. At this point in the story of creation, is person a person or is it a man and a woman?
Well, remember that what you're getting in one is a summary. It's like chapter one gives you a kind of overview. You're getting the cosmic big picture. And then it's two that the scene shifts. And now it's almost a retelling, but you're retelling it from the point of view focused on man. A way to be tipped off by that, in the first chapter, God is always referred to as God. Once you get to the second chapter, he starts being referred to as Lord. So God, you get the sense of something that is at the head of nature, the source of all being, the source of all creation. But now in two, it shifts to like this special relationship, right? Where there is Lord, there are now, right, subjects or servants. So yeah, the perspective changes. If you're a historical critical scholar, what you say is these are two different traditions that this poor overworked editor has like stitched together to try to keep them both. And the reason that isn't helpful is, haven't you ever retold a story from a different point of view? I mean, haven't you ever, in other words, told a story and you had to give a little background, and then you backtrack a little bit once that background is there, because now you can focus in on this thing you really want to talk. You had to talk about how you got the cabin, and there was this background about the cabin. Okay, now that we're clear about the family, okay, now I got to talk about my crazy sister who's always coming to get into the cabin first and creating all this trouble. But you had to give this whole background for what? Like, why do you have to pay attention to your crazy sister? Because we were the ones who repaired it, and she like came along at the end. What? Yeah. Very, you don't have to be inspired. Very ordinary storytellers will tell the same thing in different ways because of something they're up to. Very good. Next week.